Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Michael Wahid Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and a leading expert on Egypt and the Middle East. Michael, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, ever since the collapse of Hosni Mubarak's regime in 2011, Egypt has been in pretty much a nonstop unfolding political crisis that has recently reached a boiling point. Yet I wonder, how is it that we got to this impasse in the first place? So, Mubarak had been in power for 30 years, and of course he had been a friend and ally of the United States, and yet the U.S. and other Western powers seem to have distanced themselves from. So tell us a little bit, set the stage a little bit for what's happened in 2011 and since.
Well, prior to the uprising, lots had taken place to seed the environment for it to take place. It didn't come out of nowhere. I think the last 10 years in particular of the Mubarak era were a time of drift and stagnation. The problems of the country were becoming more acute, not just chronic. And so much of the energy and focus of political life was centered on the question of succession. Mubarak was old, there were rumors of ill health, and that whole time, obviously, there was a very choreographed set of steps being orchestrated to ensure Gamal Mubarak, his son, as his successor. Obviously, something quite anathema to any sort of Republican model of government. So much attention and focus and uncertainty was invested in this question of succession, and the country, frankly, was adrift. It had been poorly managed, obviously, for really 60 years, going back to the military coup by Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1952, along with the free officers. But those problems that had built up over time really intensified in that last decade, and we saw sort of green shoots of opposition. Opposition in ways and in forms that we'd never seen before. At the time, we thought these were isolated. But clearly they were breaking down taboos and normalizing notions of protests that had not been, that had not, had a rootedness in Egyptian
was
society.
Was that partly because the Mubarak regime thought, let's allow some kind of escape valve, let's allow
yes.
some of the pressure to...
Absolutely. This is particularly clear in the case of the press. As opposed to a Ba'athist state like Syria or Iraq or even Gaddafi's Libya, Egypt wasn't a totalitarian society. It was an authoritarian society, but within bounds, there was discussion and limited and controlled dissent. At the time, clearly in the 2000s, when this became more mainstream and you saw notionally oppositional press come up, clearly there was, I think, a sense within the regime that this was something like a safety valve. To have a controlled opposition tamed, with some real discussion and debate, but with certain issues, red lines and taboos. President's health, really succession was at, for many years was a red line. The military's economic interests, these were things that were not able to be fully discussed. So it was a controlled but semi-free press that was intended as a safety valve, but obviously grew up into something much more eventually.
A very good friend of mine made an observation, I spent a fair bit of time in Egypt, about how, if you travel into Middle Egypt, and you get off a train. You know, if you wander sufficiently far from the train station, what you're doing is you're leaving the zone of state authority into a zone that is, in a sense, very tribal, in which you don't have what we would think of as a kind of modern state, but rather you have a series of agreements between a modern state that is Cairo-centered, that's centered in the big cities, and that actually is engaged in a kind of accommodation with a village life that is kind of not fully touched by urbanization, modernization, and what have you. Do you think that that's a fair characterization, that, you know, kind of Egypt is a society that in a way is only incompletely modernized?
I think that's right, and I think there is a geographic variation. I mean, part of that is simply neglect. Upper Egypt, the south, has been neglected. There has been Cairo-centrism, I think it was no surprise that when there was a low-level insurgency in the 90s, a lot of the violence was focused in Upper Egypt. Whatever societal trends exist in a sort of negative sense more broadly in Egypt are exacerbated and more pronounced in Upper Egypt.
Got it. So it's basically like, okay, we have this government here. We control the ports. We control various resources to finance our military and our state more broadly. And then in these other areas, hey, we're not going to mess with you. We're also not going to provide you with much in the way of services and what have you. But you still have this traditional authority that is very entrenched in these places.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the dysfunction in governance in Egypt is the, and really in the Arab world more broadly, is the over-centralization of authority, which has really distorting effects for administration in more broadly in the country. And that's had a very negative impact on how Upper Egypt was administered.
And I imagine it also, to some degree, undermines the legitimacy of the state. Because if it looks as though you have the state in Cairo that seems to be benefiting primarily, you know, members of the military and members of the elite, and I'm out here in Upper Egypt, the state doesn't touch my life by providing me with services or what have you. So then, you know, you might look to traditional authority rather than to the government of Cairo. Is that a fair?
It's both. I mean, you know, it's not Afghanistan where the central government doesn't even manifest itself in any way. And so it's not that extreme. And of course, these arrangements were fairly stable for decades.
It's not longer. Yeah.
As the modern state has grown up, this system has managed to be fairly stable. Turbulence, obviously, but until you get to 2011, manageable. Obviously, things changed dramatically in 2011. And obviously, we talked about a lot leading up to that. But this sort of repressive stability worked, for better or worse, mostly for worse, but worked for decades.
So we come up to 2011, and you have Mubarak, who had been in power for 30 years, and of course he had this very close working relationship with the United States. The general characterization is that part of this flows from, the fact that Sadat, had signed a peace treaty with Israel, and so, you know, kind of that's one key reason to kind of want to keep this person in power. Another reason is that perhaps Mubarak could say, it's either me or the deluge. If it's not me, then you have these Islamist elements that might come to power. And that obviously was a tremendous deterrent. Yet something changed. Something in 2011 changed in which the US and other, you know, Western countries, other outsiders decided, you know what, this repressive stability is not the best bet any longer. What do you think it was,
though? Well, I mean, it was the weight of circumstance. Whether we were going to say Mubarak must go or Mubarak must stay or what have you, Egyptian society wasn't waiting for us to give that signal. They were interested in what the international community had to say. But point of fact, the United States was actually just recognizing reality. Now, it's remarkable how quickly that came. Essentially, 6 days into the, I think it's 6 days into the uprising in 2011, we see the first marked shift. You know, if you go back to 1979 and the Iranian Revolution, obviously a much more protracted affair that lasted months and months. But the United States took a very long time to reorient its policy toward the Shah.
So this
in Egypt's case,
yeah,
it really happened in light. I mean, at the time, there were people banging the table saying, "You have to do this quicker," but it happened very fast.
And you think this was an attempt to learn the lessons of history? This was an attempt to not repeat the mistakes of 1979?
Well, I think, I don't know that it was that well thought out. I think events were happening at a much faster pace. I think they correctly analyzed that Mubarak was done for. I mean, that was the central takeaway at that point in time, and I think it was right, that he was no longer a viable person to lead the country. And in fact, as opposed to, you know, being the sort of manager of repressive stability, that his very presence was now destabilizing. And I think that was an important and central insight.
There's a reason why when you have an uprising in some peripheral society, or what is seen as, Tunisia, it's a big deal, but when it happens in Cairo, suddenly, you know, that is going to be very threatening.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, Egypt is the largest country in the Arab world. And people, I think, do realize that if something major happens in Egypt, it's going to have reverberations and spill over elsewhere.
So one reason the Muslim Brotherhood has such a powerful influence is that it also created a kind of social service network in the country. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, you know, how extensive was it, and you know, how much does it still matter?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization isn't that big. There aren't that many members, right?
It's in the hundreds of thousands. I've heard about 250,000 members.
That's about 300,000. And in many ways, it has a Leninist sense of itself as a vanguard party. And of course, that has created suspicions in Egyptian society because essentially they're a secret society, separate and apart. They talk about
some
themselves.
Describe it as a cultish organization. You hear about an initiation process that take
10 stages,
3 to 8 years.
And of course, some of the people that talk about it in that fashion are Salafis, so the more rigid, hardline Islamists who see this as a sort of perversion that puts organization and the Muslim Brotherhood ahead of Islam, say. But so they are set apart. They talk about themselves as encouraging intermarriage among the Muslim Brotherhood. And yet, they've also engaged in outreach. They have been a provider of social services. And for many in the opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, this is seen as somehow buying votes and has been resented. And of course, there is an element to that. But of course, this organization is, it's over 80 years old. It is deeply rooted in society at a local, a very granular level. And part of their activity is geared toward social services. That's a longstanding activity of the brothers.
And it sounds like, so it's an organization with a very deep sense of its own history. I mean, when you have an initiation process of 3 to 8 years, I'm sure that every member is aware of the martyrs of their organization. Even if you're a member who's, 30 years old, you're going to be keenly aware of what had happened in the 50s and the repression of the organization.
Absolutely.
So they have their own counter history of Egyptian life. Now, when you describe them as a Leninist organization, when you think of a kind of Leninist political parties, they have a vision of where they want to get. They have a vision of what their utopia looks like. And so I wonder, for the Muslim Brotherhood, what is your sense of what their utopia looks like, the end goal they're trying to get to through their political activism, through their charitable endeavors, and what have you?
Well, I mean, they have a very fuzzy notion themselves. It's for a long time, it's been a sort of bottom-up process of the Islamization of society. Now, interestingly enough, this has already been happening with or without the brothers. Egyptian society looks far different, and the sort of penetration of Islam into all facets of public life looks quite different than where Egypt was 50 years ago. So the country has changed, but they still maintain this notion of Islamization of society. They see themselves as the vanguard party that can do this and will lead society in this direction. The specifics are more difficult to pinpoint. For a long time, the primary slogan of...
And by the way, they want to do this not just through laws, but also through a kind of inner cultural transformation as well,
sure.
And promoting that through...
Okay. Well, I mean, and they're a social organization. They're a dawah organization. They have these social obligations that they believe they have to fulfill in terms of raising religious consciousness within society. So for many years, it's been a very patient, long game that was essentially bottom-up. Everything changes after 2011, and it's had a really profound impact on decision-making within the brothers.
So the Muslim Brotherhood seems to have been relatively well-situated. So you have this enormous uprising, and it seems as though the Brotherhood was not actually spearheading this initial wave of resistance to Mubarak. But as that wave of resistance continued to build, as it became clear that the United States was going to abandon the Mubarak regime, then you have this large, disciplined organization that has very deep reach in Egyptian society. and they're on the playing field, and so, you know, so it seems like, you know, they're likely to have a lot of influence, right?
No, that's right. I mean, you know, they were for many years the most coherent opposition force to the Mubarak regime.
And their long sense of history probably led them to think, let's wait and see how this goes
They're not a revolutionary party, and that's part of their great downfall in power, is that they are not committed to broad sweeping change and reform. And you see this tension between the reformist class of activists that led Tahrir in its initial incarnation and the brother. This has been a tension that's been persistent. But the brothers, they're not revolutionary actors. That tension really broke apart whatever sort of ephemeral solidarity existed.
Except the revolutionary actors, because of what you had said about how, you know, secular left-wing groups, et cetera, had been so repressed during this long era, they didn't necessarily have disciplined organizations with a long sense of history that were very capable of taking advantage of this new environment. Yeah. Is that...
No, that's right. And obviously, when you get to those first... to that first set of elections in the post-Mubarak era, for me, in many ways, they are the last vestiges, sort of the last, as opposed to being the first elections of a new era, they represent for me the last elections of the Mubarak era. It's what remains from the wreckage. And of course, out of that wreckage, the brothers are organized, they're funded, they have a nationwide organizational infrastructure. They have huge organizational advantages that obviously were to their advantage in that first set of elections, the first referendum and the parliamentary elections, and then the presidential election that followed. Some of our expectations for the opposition and our frustration across the board, whether it be the analytical or diplomatic community, I think comes out of a sense of unrealistic expectations about what they could possibly do, starting from scratch in many cases, when up against what is a sort of, you know, at that time, an organizational juggernaut, something that exists already.
When you think about how the overthrow of Mubarak unfolded, I mean, you know, it really depended on the cooperation of the military insofar as, you know, it's a conscripted military, so there's the sense that, you know, these guys, you know, many of them do not want to shoot on fellow Egyptians. So it does seem that, you know, kind of playing that in a very subtle, careful way, you know, not necessarily alienating the military. Was that true of all of the opposition forces, or was that more true of the Brotherhood than others?
Well, I mean, in many ways, the brothers have had an antagonistic relationship with the military going back to, you know, the repression of the Nasserist era and thereafter, and have seen themselves as potential rivals. I mean, there are sectors within the military and the security establishment more broadly that are rabidly anti-Muslim Brotherhood. So there is a lot of resistance to the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam more generally within the security sector. At the time of the initial Tahrir uprising in 2011, before the very disastrous tenure of the military and interim power, they were greeted incredibly warmly on the streets by all the sort of actors that had come together to form that popular uprising. They were different than the police. They weren't part of domestic repression. You know, the Ministry of Interior, state security investigations, these were the repressive apparatus of the state that had direct daily interface with people. The military was behind the curtain, behind the scenes, had only been deployed to the streets twice. 1977, what has been called since is the Bread Riots, in 1986, when there were riots by the Central Security Force.
So it was a national institution that was, in a sense, above the fray, a national institution that was part of Egypt's nationalist project.
Absolutely. A great deal of pride in the institution.
So a lot of prestige.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
An unsullied reputation. Part of that was unjustified. I mean, this is an institution that has economic privileges, that is engaged in corrupt practices. Their future wasn't tethered to Mubarak. It wasn't tethered to the National Democratic Party. Their legitimacy was more broadly rooted. And while they weren't looking to oust Mubarak, they saw a way forward that was risky, but could potentially protect their interests and restore stability that wasn't necessarily tied to their defense of the president.
So this leads us to what some are calling the coup. So you have a, you know, you have Mubarak is overthrown. You have a series of elections, and then Mohamed Morsi, a guy who is not tremendously well known, someone who had been in prison for a very long period of time, is elected president by, you know, what appears to be, you know, 52% margin. You know, it seems like a, you know, reasonably free and fair election. And then he comes into power. The military acquiesces, you know, kind of despite some of these tensions between the Brotherhood and the military over time, they acquiesce. But then it seems that a lot of tension builds. And then it seems that Morsi takes a variety of steps that the military does not like. It seems that, you know, kind of there is an implicit agreement, like, hey, we're gonna work together. Sort of. And then it seems that Morsi seems to change that agreement after the fact. And then, lo and behold, he gets removed by the military. Now, there's a lot to fill in there, but yeah. I mean, but, you know, I think that, you know, because on one level you could say, well, gosh, this guy was elected, and then it seems that we're really undermining what is a nascent democratic political process by throwing this guy out of office.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but none of this was inevitable, I don't think. This, you know, there's a leadership change that happens in the military a year ago on the heels of the presidential election, and it's this second tier of military leadership that had been kept from promotion for many years because of this stagnant class of very octogenarians within the military that had stymied promotion, stymied innovation, and people within the military, I think many sectors blame them for the disaster that was the interim period of rule from the fall of Mubarak until the election of Morsi. And so this second tier of leadership comes to the fore. General Sisi, a very young man, relatively speaking, within the military, late 50s, comes to lead the defense ministry and wants to assume a more subtle behind-the-scenes role and wants to forge a working relationship with the brothers. They begin to do so. There is obviously a quid pro quo involved here, and this is most evidently seen in the Constitution, which really formalizes all of the privileges and autonomy and immunity that surrounded the military, but had been unstated, is enshrined in the constitutional document. And so the military, in many ways...
So in a way, that's a step forward. There's more transparency, there's more rule of law.
Well, in many ways, what it did was enshrine a lack of transparency. And so the military was essentially set off within the Constitution as a sort of separate... a separate organ of the government, really separate and apart from civilian oversight. And so that beneficial constitutional arrangement suggests, really, that the military, in many ways, was not in the beginning dissatisfied with where this was headed.
They were willing to do business with it.
Absolutely. They got a very favorable deal in the Constitution. They assumed that the country has very big problems. They're very bad at governance. It's much better for a civilian to be at least in the front publicly, be dealing with these issues. And so you see the possibility of a modus vivendi of sorts and perhaps a stable arrangement. The assumption underlying that is that the civilians in charge are going to be able to run the country, keep stability. I mean, you know, for the military, the two things they really care about, you know, they're misguided, yes, and authoritarian in their mindset, but they're patriots. They do care about the stability of the country. And when they think about their role as the guarantors of national security, they consider themselves as a guardian, not just of the country's national security against foreign foes, but really they think about it expansively as potentially
to put it bluntly. I mean, during sort of under Morsi's presidency, it seemed as though the country was falling apart.
It
you
was.
Have gas lines.
Yes.
You have sort of just chaos. Youth unemployment was already a problem. It seemed to have been exacerbated during this period of time. The one thing you could say, I guess, during the Mubarak era is that, you know, there was tremendous poverty, tremendous inequality, but the society was basically functioning. Whereas under Morsi, it just seemed as though it was no longer functioning. Basic institutions were breaking down.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, he faced an intransigent and uncooperative state a bureaucracy that didn't necessarily want to do business with him.
That's fascinating. So the New York Times has a new report which suggests that immediately after Morsi's removed from power, suddenly the police returned to the streets. Suddenly civil institutions seem to be working far more effectively than they had before. And so, you know, some Egyptians believe, Egyptians who are favorably inclined towards Morsi and the Brotherhood, seem to believe that there was a kind of conspiracy to undermine.
I think it's overstated, frankly. The police have been on the streets for some time. The security vacuum exists because of the unique circumstances in the country. Part of it, frankly, is the erosion of the moral force of the police. The sort of moral authority of the state has receded. And that's hard to restore.
So just to be clear, you think that there really were failures on the part of Morsi and his administration? It wasn't just a conspiracy to undermine him. It really was they were just simply not competent.
I think it's hard to be reductive. It's a whole series of causes. But, you know, one of them is that is the decision to contest the presidency to begin with. They reneged on a pledge early on during the transition not to run for the presidency. As a way of reassuring people who had participated in the revolution with them, people wary of the Brotherhood, that we, as the Brotherhood, the most organized political force, are not going to seek a monopoly on the state. And it was a huge mistake, obviously, in retrospect, partly because they created a series of backlashes that made their rule much more complicated. And if you're going to assume the presidency in the face of an intransigent bureaucracy, part of your job is to figure out how to get this machinery to work.
It does seem as though Morsi overplayed his hand, shortly after having cooperated with the United States, vis-a-vis a crisis in the Sinai and sort of, vis-a-vis how is an Islamist government in Egypt going to deal with Hamas, for example, and other groups. So then, when it seemed as though he had the confidence of the United States, then suddenly he was eager to take more power from the military. And then, it makes sense the military would resent that. So, I mean, do you see that as the fundamental problem, that he kind of, became too ambitious in terms of what the amount of power he could take?
Well, I mean, partly it was people have always said the brothers have their finger on the sort of pulse of Egypt. And it turns out they didn't. And they read something far more permanent and essential in the electoral results of the past few years, a sense that this is the political equilibrium of Egypt, them ascendant. And it bred a certain sense of denigration of the opposition, as inauthentic, as unrepresentative, out of touch elites.
Meaning the opposition to the Brotherhood.
The political opposition to the Brotherhood. And it plays into them this vanguard sense of their role in Egyptian society, and so you see this trend of not just zero sum politics, but a real disdain for the opposition, an unwillingness to even engage with them. They engage the military because they have to; it's a powerful party. They engage also with the Salafi parties, who did surprisingly well in the first parliamentary elections. But they read, as do many foreign diplomats, they read these electoral results as bespeaking something much more fundamental about Egyptian society. And in the end, this is a chaotic, fractured opposition. The political parties are not able to capture the full spectrum of opposition sentiment. And so you get somewhat skewed results. And so the opposition sentiment in the country is more diffuse, but not fully represented by, say, the first parliament in Egypt. And of course, that you couple that with the growing resentment to the failures of the Morsi government, and you get an expanded opposition. And they, frankly, didn't know it. They didn't see it coming. And that's part of their sort of insular mindset and an assumption that this opposition was foreign, was funded by the Gulf, by the Emirates and the Saudis.
So they dismissed it because they didn't think it was real. They thought, this is just kind of like a group of effete, kind of urbanites,
urban
and they don't represent the kind of the heart of the country. Now, that's not just a view that's held by the Brotherhood. That seems to be a view that's held by some people in the U.S. as well.
That's right.
So, you know, kind of one view. So we hear about how there were massive street protests against Morsi that kept building and building. And sort of some numbers you hear is as many as 14 million people right. in the streets, which is quite a lot in a country of 85 million people.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, then the question is, well, look, the Brotherhood is deeply rooted in Egyptian society. And then, you know, once Morsi is removed, you now have growing protests of people who support the Brotherhood and people who seem to be willing to really risk life and limb in order to get Morsi restored.
Right.
So you seem to be in this strange dynamic where, you know, kind of partly we're making political determinations based on which group can get more bodies out in the street, which kind of already seems kind of chaotic in itself. But then, you know, the other view is that, you know, maybe those of us in the West are kind of inclined to think that the liberal, secular opposition, you know, they're actually the guys, you've got a lot of, you know, leading American public intellectuals saying that, hey, this coup isn't so bad. And it seems like this very confusing message, because part of what we're trying to say is that, hey, you know, we might not like Islamists, but, you know, kind of like, the United States has been too associated for too long with backing military regimes and what have you. So kind of like, you know, we ought to have given this more of a shot. And then by saying that the coup's not so bad, you know, maybe we're...
Yeah, I mean, look, there are important equities involved on both sides of this issue. And it is complicated. I mean, it's trite to say, but it's incredibly complicated. There was a genuine popular uprising, a popular uprising that in scope and size... surpassed that, the topple of Mubarak. For the defenders of what happened, they will say this is revolutionary continuity.
How is it that it's... So is it because the culture of the country has changed so that actually people who would not have been, who would not have taken to the streets before are now emboldened to
absolutely,
do so?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, how did you get to this massive outpouring? Well, you know, there are sort of four factions of slices and sort of segments of Egyptian society. You have the Islamist current. We know about them well. We have the reformist opposition that sort of led the initial uprising in Tahrir. You have the supporters of the former regime, and then you have what Egyptians call Hizb al-Kanaba, the party of the couch, the people who have long been assumed to be the silent majority that are slightly apolitical and have never come to the street.
Egypt is a society where you didn't have this kind of mass protest for a very long time, for 30 years.
Right.
Then suddenly you have these protests in 2011, and then you have another wave of protests in 2013 that are bigger than those that came before them. So, I mean, how did people learn how to bring down a government? How did they learn to communicate with each other in what had been a very repressive society? And what changed between 2011 and 2013 in terms of literally just the techniques and technologies that
right.
people were using to get people out on the street?
Well, I mean, we should remember that not only were there protests in 2011 that we know about in 2013 that we just saw, but there has been a sort of continuous wave of protests that has roiled the country ever since. And so the protests really have never stopped. I mean, it's quite remarkable. I mean, there, in some sense, is a sort of a professional class of protesters. They know how to protest.
And 40% youth unemployment's got to be part of that
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And there's a committed activist class that has grown up. But clearly, to get this level of mass mobilization, you have to be tapping into something much, much broader. You know, this last wave of protest was centered on a signature campaign called Tamarrud, which means a sort of rebel campaign. I think what happened on June 30th is that the opposition largely came out. You had the supporters of the former regime coming out, creating a very strange tactical alliance, one that has really been the key divide within the non-Islamist space and dented their ability to be really effective. And then lastly, you had two additional factors. One, the softening of Islamist support for Morsi, the biggest Salafi party, the Nur party, called for early elections and didn't come out in the street for in support of him. So it softened his base of support in terms of the protests. And because of economic scarcity and deprivation, you had people from this fourth, apolitical current, come out to the streets for the first time. And so you had this really...
Just by the general deterioration of services,
absolutely.
They're just mad as hell. Okay.
So it's an inchoate movement. It's hard to know what this means, what it represents, what it can stand for, if anything. But it's reflective of this much broader opposition sentiment that wasn't fully captured by electoral outcomes.
So, Michael, you're someone who cares deeply about Egypt. You've spent a lot of time there. You have family there. And one thing that we're hearing now is that we're going to see persistent civil strife. Some even speak of a civil war. I mean, you know, you see that, you know, again, 14 million people on the street to get Morsi out, and now you have people who seem to be willing to throw their bodies, you know, kind of on bayonets. I mean, sort of really willing to die in order to redress what they see as a very grave injustice in the overthrow of Morsi. Do you believe that more violence is inevitable and this is going to spiral out of control, or do you think that there's going to be some kind of new political maturity to prevent something like that from happening?
I think it depends on the decisions made in the very near term, frankly. I mean, I don't think anything is set in stone. I think, more broadly, the potential for civil strife has been there for quite some time. I mean, I don't think it's just a function of June 30th. I've been, frankly, warning about this for months now. And not to say that it's inevitable or even likely, but possible. For too long, people have assumed that Egypt, you know, someone quipped that Egyptians are to muddling through what the Germans are to engineering. You know, that this is what the Egyptians do. They'll manage to get to some suboptimal, messy outcome, but they'll get through without really going off the rails and getting to a worst case scenario.
So what you needed was, it's fair to say that what you needed was a more magnanimous political leadership. You needed someone to come into power and be like, I represent this current, I don't necessarily represent everyone, I need to be respectful of that, and we're into this very delicate political transition, and if I'm trying to achieve certain long-term political objectives, this is not necessarily the time to do that.
That's right. I mean, and
you think Morsi tried to move too fast in kind of you know, controlling the levers of power and advancing his agenda?
It's a whole host of things. In some sense, he had an illusory sense of his grip on power. Mm-hmm. And what he could do.
He thought that 52% was a lot more solid than it really was.
Yes.
He thought that, okay.
And that he could really come in and not reform the institutions of the state, but co-opt it to his advantage. And maybe come to some sort of operating agreement on
tacit. So now, in this transitional period again, you know, we need that kind of magnanimity again. We need some kind of figure who is. Is there anyone who has that kind of legitimacy?
Not
in Egyptian
at the moment.
Society?
I mean, people have always said, look, the brothers are political party and political players. They're always going to be looking for political advantage. You know, and that's fine. But this is a transitional setting, and this goes for all of the parties. The Brotherhood come in for disproportionate blame because they have had disproportionate power in the recent past. This is a divided country. It's polarized. It is a sensitive period of transition that is trying to refashion a new social contract. Foundational documents like a constitution can't be agreed to on a 50% plus one basis. It's not going to be sustainable. And I said it at the time, and I'm sorry to say that it's really come true. But you know, that constitution that institutionalized the country's political crisis clearly is not going to be sustainable, and it's not going to last. So there's got to be some baseline threshold level of maturity and consensus. That tries to cobble together some new social contract, because no one faction can govern Egypt. The Brotherhood made that mistake.
I hate to do this because this is very grim, but so what you're saying is that, you know, we need some level of political maturity and magnanimity. This is a society that's been incredibly scarred by violence. Resentments that have been in place for decades, if not longer than that. I mean, a real deep sense of history as well. So let's say you do have persistent civil strife. Let's say that's the direction we go. Does that have the potential to spill over outside of Egypt? Does that have the potential to kind of introduce real instability elsewhere? Because, you know, right now it seems that the Middle East in the post-Arab Spring era, it just seems that there's so much dislocation, so much potential for strife.
Yeah, I mean, I think the possibility is real. I mean, Egyptians have sort of comforted themselves in saying, we're not Syria. We're not Iraq. We don't have this history of bitter division that has spilled over into violent conflict. Egypt's a real country. Its borders aren't a colonial creation. And so that sense of national identity for many has been seen as a buffer. And of course it has been. But at some point, the social fabric can only be so resilient. Under enough stress, certainly, civil strife is possible in Egypt. And again, as we said earlier, what happens in Egypt obviously has outsized impact on the region. Instability in Egypt is a disaster, obviously, for Egyptians. But more broadly, it would be a real tragedy for the region.
Is there anything the United States can do? Is there anything, the U.S. leadership to kind of minimize those risks?
It's difficult. The United States has been in a difficult position, frankly, since the fall of Mubarak. I think what you see, in fact, is not a really erratic or changing or even evolving policy. It's true that now we are willing to deal with the Brotherhood and political Islam and Salafi groups that were seen as beyond the pale before, which was a mistake. But the sort of core continuity is there in the sense that Egypt, the U.S.-Egypt bilateral relationship is primarily, and probably rightly so, about U.S. regional security interests. And to the extent that those are fulfilled, the domestic situation takes on lesser importance. I think the key conclusion that we have to draw from this very tumultuous 2+ years now is that bargain on repressive stability is no longer on offer. It can't work. And so if we're seen to be betting on a winning horse, that's one not going to work in the sense of bringing about stability in Egyptian society, and two, it's going to poison our relationships with some of the other currents. We see some of this in Egypt now. Some of it is grossly exaggerated. I mean, there are wild, concocted conspiracies about the United States and the Brotherhood that have absolutely no basis in reality, that have taken on a life of their own in a very heightened nationalistic
Hillary
setting.
Hillary Clinton is in cahoots with the Brotherhood because of her chief of staff.
Yeah, I mean, crazy talk.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. I think we have made a series of tactical mistakes in terms of our posture and approach to this fluid and evolving situation. In the end, obviously, agency for Egypt's future lies with Egyptians. I think it is important. The United States still plays a very important role. We saw this in the moment of crisis. The only outside party that had channels of communication and was talking to both the military and the Muslim Brotherhood was the United States. And I do think the sense of U.S. decline in the Arab world is exaggerated to a large degree, and rests on a notion of ahistoricity, in the sense that a past never existed. The United States was never able to dictate political outcomes in the Arab world. It's not able to do that now, but it still plays a central role, a role that no other outside party can play. And that's important to keep in mind.
Got it. So, don't necessarily cut off aid. Stay engaged.
Well, yes. I mean, that's... Stay engaged goes without saying. I mean, I don't think
But there's
think
no particular thing we should do, try to kind of navigate this period as kind of...
I think we have to approach the issue with a great deal more finesse. We've been sort of blunt in wanting to deal with one concentration of power, in continuing the sort of the practice of trying to deal with the party in power in a way that I think has given our policy a bad reputation.
Michael, thank you very much. This was tremendous.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.